Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer. 111-110. Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino. Today I have with me a very special guest, one of our Street Cop survivors, going to tell a great story about surviving a critical incident. And without further ado, Drew Stokes. Drew, give everybody the 1 to 2 minute background of who you are, where you're from, how long you were on the job, and then we'll go into the details of the incident.
Okay. Yeah. My name is Drew Stokes. I live in Jacksonville, Florida, originally from North Carolina. I joined the Coast Guard straight out of high school, did 6 years in the Coast Guard, 6.5 years active duty. Last few years, I was stationed with the Legacy Customs Service, surveilling the southern border, looking for aircraft, basically crossing the border. Ended up getting a fly-in job, transferred to Jacksonville, Florida, was able to fly in the back of P3s, do long-range drug interdiction, big loads, anything from, you know, 1,000 to 10,000 pound cocaine load type stuff. Was able to go to academy, become a federal agent in 2008. I flew with customs and did a lot of interdiction stuff via general aviation aircraft for many, many years until I got shot in September of 2017. Retired July 3rd of last year due to my injuries and pretty severe post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Man, that must have been cool doing those counter-surveillance flights and all that shit.
It was awesome. I mean, we did, my job every day, I got to go to work with my best friends. They gave us a $40 million airplane and told us to go fly. And during my time, I did about 8,000 hours of flight time in P3s, which is a large four-engine aircraft. Also flew in smaller twin-engine aircraft, single-engine aircraft, and helicopters. So everything customs or CBP Air and Marine had, I flew in, and I was a mission commander in the MQ-9 Predator as well.
Wow. Comfortable ride in a P3?
Loud, very, very loud. You know, it's a 1950s designed airplane. Our newest airplane was built in 69, I think.
Super comfortable in the air though, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I love flying. It was, I loved it. I always wanted to fly. You know, it's like the first time I saw Top Gun, and I always wanted to be Goose. You know, I never wanted to be Maverick. I always wanted to fly, but I never had any desire to be the guy wiggling the sticks. So I landed my perfect job, just kind of dumbed into it. But I mean, I worked hard for it. When I saw an opportunity, I took it.
Any desire to fly now?
Not really. I pretty much got that all out of my system for, once you get out there and you get the crap scared out of you a few times. We used to chase airplanes like, you know, a regular street cop would chase a car. We chased airplanes and we would get up behind them. You know, you get within, you know, 100 feet of them, maybe even closer than that. Wow. In flight, you know, they would never know you were there. And we were in this big four engine airplane and they're in little single engine airplanes. But we just flew with the best pilots in the world, man, to keep that big airplane in the sky at those slowest speeds. We truly had the best the best tactical pilots, you know, as far as P3 or large aircraft go on the planet. There's no doubt about it.
What are some of those oh shit moments? Do you want to share a few of those?
There's some, obviously weather. Sometimes, you know, you get sucked into a thunderstorm or something like that. I remember we got in one big cell somewhere off of Panama one day, and I had locked something up on the radar. And then when we popped up out of the cell, I felt the airplane turn and climb. And I asked the pilot who was flying. I said, what's going on? We got to look at this. He goes, you locked up a water spout. So that's what we were flying into, a water spout, until we come up the other side of it. So anytime you're in large thunderstorms, it really sucks. That's probably the most scared I've been tactically. Sometimes, you know, just flying through the mountains and sometimes like that, especially you have to understand, in the back of the airplane, we didn't have any windows. So it was no windows, and we sat sideways in the airplane. So we didn't sit facing the nose. We sat facing the left wing. So sometimes when the airplane would do stuff, you know, guys would, some types of in-flight emergencies would suck. You know, we had one where we had a control failure with our rudder, and that stuff's pretty scary. You're heading out to sea with 50,000 pounds of fuel on the airplane, and like, man, what are we going to do? But like I said, the guys I flew with, they were such professionals. They were such good at their what they did. They trained and trained. We all trained, and we trained in the sky as far as being aviators and air crew, and we also trained on the ground for being trying to be the best damn cops that we could. So we tried to do both.
It's awesome, dude. That's really fucking interesting.
Yeah, it was a tremendous career. There's no doubt about it. I'm lucky that I got to serve my country for nearly 30 years. The agency I worked for was Air and Marine Operations. They could not have been better to me during this whole process. That's for sure.
That's awesome, man. That's great to hear. All right, so I guess to the story now.
Sure. I got to put a little history into it. So really the story starts when Hurricane Harvey hits San Antonio, Texas, or I'm sorry, hits Houston. So that's where the story kind of begins. So I go to help out. We go to San Antonio because that's where all of our CBP aircraft were. So I don't do anything big. I handle some stuff during the night while the flight crews are sleeping, get things ready for the next day, that type of stuff. So that's kind of where this starts. So then Hurricane, I can't remember which one it was. I think Ida was heading towards Jacksonville at the time. So they told us, they're like, all right, the waters are receding. Come home. And then we have to evacuate our airplanes and go through Ida. So we go through it. We come through relatively unscathed in Jacksonville. We go get our airplanes. And then Hurricane Harvey starts to rear up, and we know it's going to be bad. And we know it's going to hit Puerto Rico and then the Leeward Islands out there. So we know it's going to be bad. So the agency did a good job. We were going to get ahead of it. So I'm going to say it was like September 22nd, 23rd of 2017. They send four or five of us out there. I'm the only one in the back of the airplane. And we basically just, we send an airplane out to El Paso, Texas to pick up an SRT, an ICE SRT guys, or HSI. We picked those guys up, and on the way to San Juan, we start our crew day in El Paso, and we're going to San Juan, Puerto Rico, which the airplane's got plenty of legs for that. En route, they stop us. They say, hey, we need you guys to land in Homestead and pick up another SRT crew. So we do. We pick up another crew, and this time we had every ditching station on the airplane was full. And if anything happened to that airplane, we weren't getting out of it. So I told those guys that we're leaving. I said, listen, we're if something happens, which it's probably not, you know, but we still had to fly through a couple of the bands of the hurricane and all kinds of stuff, which is P3s are what they do. You know, NOAA uses them to fly into hurricanes. So we land in San Juan. We dump off a team. We land in Aguadilla, dump off a team. Well, they tell us, they're like, hey, you're going to bring people back home. Bring back home to Jacksonville. So there's a plane ahead of us. It was full. Our plane had four people on it. And it was two contractors. It was a grandmother and a granddaughter. And we take off. And I realize, I'm like, these people, they don't have any food. They don't have anything. They essentially just went through an atomic bomb and that lasted for days. And they don't have anything. The girl, she was so scared. It was right near, it was September 23rd or 4th. So I think she just got her Halloween costume and it was a shark suit. And I still have the picture of the little girl. And she was in a shark suit and she was scared. So I realized, I figured it out. I was like, man, they're probably hungry and they probably want to sleep. So they didn't have any food. So we gave them all of our food that we had. So we as the air crew, we chipped in. We had candy or, you know, whatever. We had stuff to give them to basically for the 4-hour flight back to Jacksonville. The aircraft had four beds in the back of it because it flies for so long. We rotate crews through. So you'll always have an extra pilot, extra flight engineer, and extra guys in the back. So we just gave them our beds so they could rest. So you got to remember the airplane, it's dark, it's loud, it stinks. You know, you got all that stuff going on. So we let them sleep. We land. And I think about it when I get back. You know, when I get home, I just start processing it. So on September 27th of 2017, I was scheduled to fly back down to Puerto Rico. And I talked with the boss and I said, hey, I'm going to go shop for the flight, get ready for the flight. And this time I'm not going to get caught with our pants down again because nobody had thought of this. So I go to a Publix in Jacksonville, Florida, or it's actually in Orange Park, Oak Leaf, which is just south of Jacksonville. I walk in, I do my shopping. You know, I get like coffee creamer, some stuff, cooking a bag, stuff we can cook on the airplane. Just a couple bags full of food. So when I'm leaving, I walk out to my truck to get back in and take stuff back to the office. Whenever I'm walking out of the door, I walk through in Florida, at least in Publix, usually so there's doors on each side of a building. And then there's kind of like a center lane that you drive down. So I was walking down the center that was in between the two doors. and the traffic should have been coming towards me, right? All the car traffic should have been coming towards me. I was approached from behind. I didn't see it and I didn't hear it because it was a BMW. And I had on my flight suit. I had on a shirt that said CBP federal agent on the back of it. And then I hear a voice just scream, "I fucking hate cops." And then five shots, bang, 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 just like that. The whole thing lasted maybe a second, second and a half. He shot me with five 9mm hollow points, point blank range, no vest, and then put a bullet in his own head. And it was in a drive.
I remember this story. I remember it very vividly when it occurred.
Yeah. So the car takes off. The first shot hits me center mass. It hits me right underneath here. That bullet goes through, but it severs my liver and stops in my spine. The second one went through my right buttocks, went through my rectum internally and stopped in my left hip. So as you know, we always train to turn towards our threat, right? So I had dropped my groceries. I had a shoulder holster on, which I'll never, ever wear again. And I've encouraged nobody to ever wear one because the draw is so slow. And I even trained for it and it was still slow. And so I got my hand on the gun and that's whenever the first shot hit me is when I touched the gun. But I was still trying to turn. So he was on this side of me. So I was turning towards him, trying to get my gun out. But the impact from the bullets... So the third bullet hit me from the front. It hit me in my right leg, and that one hit my pelvis and stopped. The fourth one went through my left leg, and then the fifth one went through my left arm right here. So I couldn't stand up. There was no, you know, I got shot at such close range, and the impact was, I tell people, it's like you think about what a 22-year-old Mike Tyson hitting you with no glove on as hard as he could in ribs. I'm guessing that's about what it felt like. But it was catastrophic. My knees buckled. I went down to the ground. Once I got down on the ground, once I fell, I finished my draw. So I got my gun out and I pointed down range and I looked at my left arm. And when I did, these holes that were in my arm were just, I don't know if you can see them or not, but anyway, they were big. They were like the size of nickels. And it was just the muscle mass was hanging out of the bottom of my arm. So, but I was like, all right. So I was trying to push myself up, but I knew that I couldn't. I was like, my arm didn't work. Neither one of my legs worked. I was in this pain, but I knew I had to get this guy. So he was gone. I get my gun out. There was a white F-150 in front of me. And I was a firearms instructor as well for customs. So I had a lot of rounds through this gun. I knew exactly where the hammer was going to fall. So I saw under the truck, I knew which way the car went. So under the truck, I see feet coming underneath the truck. I rotate around. I think I get around the back of the truck, but I can't tell you to be sure. I think I do. I get around to the back of the truck. And I'd made a decision I'm going to kill this person because I figured it was the guy that was coming back to finish me off. So I had all the slack pulled out of the trigger and I knew that it was a skinny white kid that shot me. I knew that. And the person that came around the back of the truck was not a skinny white kid. It was a heavy set mid-40s white guy. And he came over and I had my gun pointed at him. And at that point, I went into firearms instructor mode. I was like, I got a fully loaded gun. I've got my finger inside the trigger guard with all the slack pulled out of the trigger. I don't have a target. And then if I send a bullet, where the hell is it going to go and who's it going to hit? I actually, all those things went through my head like that. And so he came around and he said, "Hey, he's gone. He's gone. He's gone. He's dead. He's dead. He's dead." And he put his finger, his hand, he goes, "You can't get up." Cause I was trying to stand up. He goes, "Stay down, stay down. He's gone." And I knew at that point that everybody here was in shock. I knew I was in shock cause I was pissed off. I mean, we're talking maybe this whole thing is maybe in 15, 20 seconds. And so I tell him, I'm like, "Hey man, call 911, officer down. That's all you got to tell them. 911, officer down, and tell them where we're at. Tell them we're at the Oakley Phase 2 Publix." I gave him all that. Then another guy, so I hear him making the calls and another guy's, he goes, "Do you need me to call anybody?" I said, "Yes." I actually said, "I need you to call my office." I gave him the phone number and the person to talk to at the same time. So I told him because I knew that they would need to get going. I knew that they needed to notify my wife and all that kind of stuff. So I sit back and I start to assess myself. And I'm thinking, so for a fleeting moment, I'm like, man, I could die in this parking lot today. And then I immediately got that out. And I said, "I am not dying in this parking lot today. I'm not doing it." So I say about that time, I see there's like a big river of blood that's like running down my side. Now you got to remember, I'm in Jacksonville, Florida. You know, it's a million degrees outside. It's still summertime. You know, and I'm boiling on this black asphalt. I'm really, really hot. So I'd made a decision. I was like, I'm going to live. I'm going to get through this, and I'm going to figure out. I've got to assess myself first. So I actually wiggled my toes. I told myself, I said, Drew, wiggle your toes, man. Wiggle your toes. Let's feel the toes inside them boots. And as soon as I felt that, I'm like, all right, I'm not paralyzed. Good. That's a good thing. I'm like, all right, that's good news. So then one thing that we taught at our survival school was PMA plus 98.7, positive mental attitude plus 98.7, plus your body temperature. You keep those two things. That is your recipe for survival. That's your formula for survival. PMA plus 98.6. So that's what I did. I actually went through that. I'm like, all right, positive mental attitude. It's like, so I started, I started setting goals. So my goals for myself went from, you know, saving, getting towards retirement, having enough money, that type of stuff to, all right, new life goals are let's listen for the sirens, stay conscious, listen for the sirens. Now, meanwhile, at this time, there's people from Publix coming out, pharmacists, there's a doctor's office there, nurses coming out. And they brought out, and they were starting to plug the holes in me with, because there was many, many of them. And they started putting paper towels on me and doing the best they could. Another guy said, hey, I got some powdered Quick Clot. Do you want me to put that on you as well? And I said, absolutely. You know, because I knew they weren't supposed to use it, but I also knew that this is all we had to keep the blood. And I told them, I said, you have to keep the blood in a container. Keep the blood in a container. Keep the blood in a container. I'm the container. Keep the blood in a container. Stop the bleeding, because there was nothing I could do to stop it. So they poured the powder stuff into the wound or the hole in my shirt. None of it actually made it to me at all. It all stayed on the inside of my shirt, and I still have all those the clothes and stuff. I'll tell you where they are here in a minute. So we start going through. I was like, all right, I can hear sirens. Cool. So, and I knew they were getting closer. I knew the cavalry was coming. I knew I had a loaded gun. I still had a gun with my finger on the trigger. So it was laying right here in front of me because I didn't know who else was out there. So the first two responding officers get there. Jake Hawkins comes in and he starts running towards me. So I know he's coming. I know he's got a loaded 45. I know, you know, obviously the loaded for cops, that's how we carry our guns. But he's got a 45 in his hand. I know I don't want any of that. We wear a non-standard uniform, right? So the sheriffs in Florida wear their standard uniform is a green uniform, where mine was brown. So I didn't want him to come towards me and thinking that maybe I'm the shithead. So he comes to me and I start screaming. This is something we actually train for in our survival school because we're such a small agency. Nobody knows who we are. That I just started screaming, I'm a cop, I'm a cop, I'm a cop, I'm a cop, I'm a cop. So that way he would hear that as he's coming in and assessing his situation. So he gets there. He's like, hey, bro, let the gun go. Let the gun go. So he's like, I say, I can't. I say, he says, I'm here. It's fine, man. He says, it's fine. I said, I'm Jake Hawkins from the Sheriff's Department. He says, I got you, man. I got you. You're going to be fine. So he had just done some medic refresher training as well. He had a medic bag in his car. So he actually put two tourniquets on me. So in addition to, I didn't know at the time, but I had seven holes in my body. So in addition to the seven holes, he put a tourniquet on my left leg, a tourniquet on my left arm. And then for the in my side right there where it went and broke my ribs, he actually stuck his finger in that to stop the bleeding.
Wow.
Until he could get an occlusive dressing on me. And Jake was which I didn't know at the time. He was a rodeo guy. He was a bull rider. And he had laid down on top of me to keep me down. And I actually, when he did that, I pushed up and I bucked him off. And he got back on top of me. He says, you can't do that. He says, I had to stop the bleeding. You got to deal with the pain. So he gets there. So we do that. You know, he gets that. About that time's when the fire department gets there, you know, because they had to stage, of course. They got to do what they got to do, right? They got to follow their own rules. So those guys get there and they were awesome, man. I had a great paramedic. Everybody was in the ambulance. It was great. The fire station 26 there in Clay County, man, they are just fantastic. Well, the whole department is fantastic, along with the sheriff's office. They flipped me over. Jake says I look really, really gray, look really, really bad. He puts me on the stretcher. They put me on the stretcher, put me into the ambulance. You know, once I get an IV started in me. So I'm in the back. I'm like, guys, we got to go. I knew it was bad. I said, we got to go. And they said, hang on, we got to get an IV on you and all this stuff. So they're doing it. I said, guys, we got to go. We don't have time. So Jake comes, he goes, hey man, I got to know what happened. So he comes to the back of the ambulance. He says, I got to know what happened. I said, Jake, I said, the fucking coward shot me in the back. And he goes, Roger that. That's all I need. Slammed the doors and off we went. So on the way, my paramedic and I were talking. He said, "Do you want me to call my wife? Or call your wife?" I said, "No, I'll talk to her when I wake up." And I asked him, I said, "Do you think I'm going to die?" And he said, "Well, you got a 50-50 shot." So we had a talk after that to never say that to a patient again. So he was a lieutenant for the fire department. We're really good friends now. So they actually passed out on the way to the, from blood loss. I eventually passed out. I fought it for as long as I could. And then when we pulled into Orange Park Medical Center, they actually hit the curb and that's when, and I woke up. So whenever they brought me out at some point, the last thing I remember before going out was I saw my friend, Bill Freehafer. I saw him and he just gave me I said, "Bill, how you doing?" He gave me a thumbs up. And then my direct supervisor, his name's Steve Wood. I said, "Woody," I said, "how you doing, man?" He looked at me and he just started crying. So he couldn't really get anything out. And then I looked at them. I was like, "Well, this is one way to beat the line at the ER." And then, they bring me in, assess me, I go into surgery. At some point, the shooter's friends decided they wanted to come to the hospital and finish me off.
Whoa.
So they actually put that on social media. Of course, coming to the hospital with having to shoot through 300 cops to get to me and, you know, find me in whatever OR I'm in, good luck. So we actually had people in the OR with me. You know, my guys were in there. And then also the sheriff's department guys were there. It's been 5 years, man. It still gets me every time. So because one of my friends tells me, he tells a story. He's a great guy. He's a FedEx pilot now, but he tells me a story. He's like, "Man, because it was weird. They pulled your intestines out and they put them over here and then they were working on you." So anyway, I go in surgery number one. They start trying to find the bleeder in my liver. And that's the big thing. So the lacerated liver. And they get me patched up. I start to, I guess this is the story they told me. They bring me out. They bring my wife in and say, "Hey, do you want to see him?" She says, "Yes." Well, when they brought her in, she got to within about 10 feet of me and I went into cardiac arrest.
Oh, good Lord.
Went back in there. They ended up putting 19 trauma units of blood in me. So 19 units of blood, 19 units of red blood cells, 19 units of white blood cells, and 19 units of plasma. So about 73 different units, 70 some different units, are what they put inside of me. And so the Sirocco-Glue dose, so the doctor's name was Elias Sirocco-Glue. So he works on me. He actually goes out, leaves surgery. They have another cardiac thoracic surgeon working on me, actually goes and tells my wife that I'm going to die, but he's going to do everything he can to save me. So he's a young guy, you know, he's probably late 30s at this time. So he comes back in, scrubs back in, starts working on the liver. And this is something I didn't know, is that the liver is apparently like jello. They say it's like trying to sew jello, right? So he's trying to sew all these little blood vessels up. But what happens is as they're sewing, it just pops off, right? That part of the liver just pops off. So and I'm bleeding faster than they can catch the blood coming out of me, A, and B, put it into a centrifuge, because they ran the hospital out of blood, the entire blood bank out for me. The theory is, and Sirocco-Glue and I have never talked about this, but he went out and said, "Hey, I need blood." And, you know, all those cops are like, take as much as you want, man. You know, because of course it's what I would do for you. I know you would do it for me. We do it for each other. There's no doubt about it. It's not even a question. It's just, you just do it. So he goes back in and says, "All right." So he goes back in and starts working on my liver. The other surgeon calls my time of death. He says, "No," essentially throws some Hail Mary stitches on my liver and they hold. And, I end up going to cardiac arrest again at some point. I don't know where I went into it. I know I went into it twice. I went to the other side twice. A lot of people have asked me, and I freely tell them this. They're like, "Did you see the light?" And the answer is I did not. I did not see a light, but I did see something. I saw my grandmother. I saw an image of my grandmother, and I saw two of my coworkers that just said, "We're not ready for you yet." And then I don't know where it happened. I don't know if it happened when Sirocco-Glue threw the stitch, or if it's 20 seconds before they pulled out my intubation tube and woke me up. I don't know. I can't tell you. I just know it happened in there somewhere.
Is that other side crossing experience? Because that intrigues me tremendously. Is that the only thing you remember from that? It's just that? How vivid was it?
Vivid. I can still see it right now. I can still see the image of my grandmother. The way, and I had to talk about this with my dad because he asked me some questions about it. It's like she just was as I remembered her. You know, she was just dressed. She looked like I remembered her. It was a black and white image. And then the other guys were two of my mentors, you know, that I flew with early in my career that retired and died. And they just said, we're not ready for you yet.
And what was your theories or thoughts on the other side prior to this versus now after experiencing this?
You know, I probably would have said it's a lot of bullshit. Probably until I experienced it. It definitely, you know, this whole experience changed my view on a lot of things.
Mm. I'd like to hear those things after you talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know that they say God puts people in places for reasons. And I know that he was, you know, somehow guiding Soraka Glue's hands to save my life. Mm. Now, whether it's to continue telling this story, you know, hoping someday, somewhere, somebody's going to hear it and be motivated by it to do whatever, to get themselves in better shape or become a cop or not become a cop or do whatever it is to help save their lives. I hope it does. I hope that's why I'm here.
You know, Drew, I know that you're digging deep, as a parent, but I think that you should give yourself a lot of credit for having the courage to step up to this platform and actually be able to share your story because it will help people. There's no question about it. Your thoughts on the other side is like it exists, huh?
It did for me. I don't know. You know, everybody's got their own feelings on religion and that type of stuff. You know, I believe in God, and whatever I believe is what I saw. And I believe that it would be the same for anybody else in what they believe. Right. So, it's not necessarily what I saw is the way it is for everybody. Some people may believe different things and the images may be different for them. And they may have may look at what happened to me a different way. You know, they may take a total science-based approach and say, well, the guy was just a damn good surgeon. I think it was a little combination of both.
How about all the other people who have been on this podcast who have gone through similar circumstances as you have and all say the same thing?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we can't all be wrong, right?
How does it all the same thing over and over again?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you.
And I think that restores a lot of hope and faith into people. And, you know, Drew, unfortunately, there might be some people who listen to this podcast that are facing some dire circumstances.
Yeah, I'm sure there are.
And I think it gives a little relief to everybody to know that there's more to life than this, as we all will continue to one experience it amongst loved ones, and we will have the same path at the end. It's the same, we're all going to the same place. So whether you want to consider it to be scary or not, I think what you've provided to start was comfort.
Yeah. I think about death a lot, and it's not that I want to die, because that's not it at all. I very much want to live, right? I've been given this incredible opportunity. So I'd very much want to live, but I you wonder about what it's like, you know, if it's going to be that way, you know, whenever the real day comes, is it going to be that way? I can tell you this, it was painless. At that point, it was completely painless. I wasn't feeling anything. So that's a good thing.
These podcast episodes are my favorite because I leave with a new appreciation for my life.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, the journey I've been on has really made me feel very mortal and very vulnerable as well.
Right.
And I just need to hear it from guys like you and other girls as well to sure. know how mortal we actually are and the reality of things. So let's go back to, you're in the hospital. Then what happened? You code a few times. They bring you back. I'm not trying to downplay the severity of it, but we've established that. Let's move forward.
Not at all. Yeah. So I get shot on September 26th. So I don't wake up. So I'm medically induced coma or sedated probably till sometime mid October. Now I don't know for sure. Right. So during that time, there was time I was awake. And I was hallucinating too. So I had really, really bad, what they call ICU psychosis. I had it, and I had a severe case of it. But some of the things I do know. So I remember nobody knew I was awake. I woke up once. I looked up. So I knew I was in the hospital. I knew I had been shot, and I knew I was in very critical condition. I knew that. My eyes were open. I looked at the TV, and I see a guy shooting a gun out of a gold window. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? But I can still hear. I've got a little bit of auditory exclusion going on. And sometimes the words, whatever hearing stuff, I don't know if what I'm hearing is true or not true, but they were talking about a guy shooting a gun out of a window in Las Vegas. And I was like, holy shit, why would anybody do that? So that was a Las Vegas shooting was going on whenever I was in the hospital. So I heard it and I understood it, but I couldn't process it, I don't think, because my brain was just somewhere else. I just didn't understand why somebody would do something like that. Anyway, I go back out. I wake up, who knows, a few days later, 3 or 4 or 5 days later, and I look over and one of my academy classmates, this guy named Jeff Burks, is in front of my door. And I had just seen him in Puerto Rico. He was down there. And I mean, our agency is really small. It's only about 1,800 people. That's it. That's it for a federal agency. It's tiny. And so I look up, I see him at my door. And I look, and he looks at me, and he's a paramedic as well. So he looks at me, and he just shoots me the finger.
That's funny.
He shoots me the finger. So I look at him, and I just shoot him the finger back.
Oh, that's so good.
And then I passed out. And then I was out for who knows how long until I woke up. You know, they woke me up. I begged them to pull out the intubation tube. And they were like, you know, I might have to go back in. I'm like, oh, I know. So they, you know, they pull the intubation tube out. You know, my dad's there, my mom's there, my wife's there. We don't have any kids, but we just have dogs. But, you know, so my family's there and they're trying to communicate with me and I can't talk, you know, so because I've had that thing in my mouth for so long. So I'm having to write on a whiteboard.
So you're able to write. You're actually able to write.
I was able to try and write. Yeah. So a few hours later I could talk, but I still didn't. This is kind of a funny part of the story. So I still couldn't talk, but I could talk a little bit. So my wife's like, hey, Rick Scott was the governor of Florida at the time. It's like, hey, Governor Scott called and he wants to talk to you. I'm like, okay. So it could have been a day later. Hell, I don't know. And so we called Governor Scott. And I don't know where he was. It sounded like he was in an airplane somewhere. I'm not sure, but we talked and I have no idea what I said to him whatsoever. I remember hearing his voice. But that's it. So we had a conversation. I look back now and I'm like, why would you let me do that? I don't have any idea what I said funny. To him.
What was it like for your family? Is the first time you're able to communicate with them?
Yes. Well, basically it was them communicating with me. So they told me, it was my wife. She was the first one to talk to me. She says, hey, you're in a hospital. I said, I know. She goes, She goes, you were shot. I said, I know. I remember. She goes, okay. She goes, well, you have some severe injuries, just so you know. I said, okay. She said, your abdomen's been cut in half. I said, okay. And she says, and they've had to go into it several times. They're trying to let it heal from the inside out. So I have a scar from the bottom of my sternum to my belt line. It's still there. It's gigantic. And she said, just so you know, you're on a colostomy bag. I said, what? Is it a colostomy? What am I on a colostomy bag for? So she's like, the part of the one of your wounds with your rectum internally, and you went septic. So they had to do that. So I'm like, all right. I'm still a CrossFitter, and I was a CrossFitter before. And one of my friends at the CrossFit gym had just went through having a colostomy bag. And he was in the gym working out, bag flapping around, no shirt on, the whole thing. And I remembered that. And I'm like, well, I said, hell, if Ken can go through it, I can go through it. She goes, you'll probably be on it for 5 or 6 months. Well, what she didn't tell me at the time was there was a big chance it was going to be permanent, but she didn't tell me that, you know, which was a good move on her part. So I'm like, well, Ken did it. I can do it. You know, it's just not going to be a big deal. So I just didn't even worry about it because I knew that it would change eventually. So I never even got down about it. So and from that moment on, my whole thing was I need to heal. I need to get the hell out of here. That's what I need to do is never woe is me. I never felt sorry for myself. You know, I know I was a cop, man. I was a federal agent, law enforcement officer. This shit happens to us. And I knew it did. And it's shitty. But I go back and I look at it and I looked at it at this time. So this kid was going to kill a cop that day. He was going to kill a cop. That was his thing. And the way I see it is there was a lot of times the Clay County Sheriff would sit in a parking lot there and they would do their paperwork at the Publix that I was at. You know, they'd sit there and they'd type on their computers, type in their reports or something. And he knew that. And that's why he went there. So I look at it as, you know, he wasn't looking to kill Drew Stokes that day. He was looking to kill a Clay County Sheriff or a Florida Highway Patrol or somebody like that. He just got me. And the only person he managed to kill was himself. So it that's kind of the way I look at it, is that, you know, I don't want to sound snobbish or conceited, but more than likely I saved a life for a local law enforcement officer in the state of Florida. There's no doubt about it.
I don't think you have to explain the truth behind that. I think everybody's well aware before you even said it what that meant. So don't feel like you have to make an excuse before you say that. Being a hero sometimes is very indirect. And sometimes you got to unpack it a little bit to understand how heroic things actually are. And if
there was nothing heroic about it. It was just, I got shot in a parking lot. I mean, it doesn't take a hero to get shot in a parking lot.
It took a hero to survive, and it took a hero to acknowledge that if it had been a different target, they may not have another cop or somebody going home to their family. So on behalf of society, you took that one for the team, for your brothers and sisters in blue. Yeah, Drew, that's a hero. That was a newsflash for you, if nobody's ever told you that before. That's a real one, my friend. Tell me about your wife.
She's pretty amazing. She was an executive for a restaurant chain at the time that took care of us pretty well. She's just an incredible human being, man. She did everything she could. She stopped everything that was going on in her life, you know, to get me better. And she worked for the company Chili's at the time. So she worked for Chili's and Chili's, they provided all the food for the hospital, all the people that were there. Wow. You know, we're not talking for a day. We're talking for the month I was in the hospital. Wow. Every day they brought food. Every day they brought in, they took care of us. They took care of her. They offered her, you know, her own post-traumatic stress, you know, because we both have post-traumatic stress, right? We just have it from different angles. You know, I have it from the physical and she has it and the emotional, and she has it from the emotional support side of it. So they actually, you know, they took care of her. There's no doubt about it. They took care of both of us. And they didn't. They've since parted ways. You know, maybe she'll get on with somebody else at some point. But right now we're just, you know, we spent the past year since I retired just basically both healing ourselves.
You know what's good about these podcast episodes? I think people start to understand the side of what it's like to be you and your family. Well, because when we see it on, you see it on Facebook, you're like, you know, I'll donate, you know, we can have so much compassion, so much empathy, but right, until actually getting into the depth, into the details of these stories, it's hard to conceptualize, and it's not anybody's fault. You know, we had this shooting yesterday in Texas where these poor kids were killed. I don't know if I felt, first of all, I haven't allowed it to come into my heart yet, because I have four kids. And oddly enough, I saw a guy last night. I had me out at an establishment doing some stuff with our people here. And he said, you see that double homicide we had somewhere in New Jersey? And I said, you know, it had to do with children. And he said, well, I was the first one there. And I'm sure he might be affected, but I just knew the way he described it, he wasn't a parent. Like, I just know that because I could never, as a father of four, just come out and say, hey, did you see that? It's even hard for me to talk about this incident. And my heart goes out. I can't imagine. I don't know what to say. I'm not even begin processing it yet. We have a hard time empathizing because we don't know.
And I
just try to put myself in your shoes, or the parents' shoes, or those kids, or the kids who go to that school. Like, you know, it's a lifetime of pain that you have to deal with. That was not part of the deal.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you didn't sign up for this shit.
Yeah. It definitely wasn't part. I mean, for me, it was part of the deal. For them, it's not part of the deal. I totally understand that. It's Amanda and I just had a conversation about it before I started a podcast, and I was telling her how we were there in Marine. We actually went through training, and I did some survival instructor stuff we actually trained in an elementary school, an abandoned elementary school for this. We would go to, and we would actually go into an abandoned elementary school and look for an active shooter. It is hard. I was telling her, I was like, it's so hard. It's so hard in that environment, even in an abandoned school, to try to find somebody that's actively killing kids. It's so hard. And, you know, probably dealing with it. And then, you know, the BORTAC guys who are the best of the best in CBP, there's no doubt about it. The agency I was with was part of CBP, and the BORTAC teams, I'm sure the DPS, they're trained together for this type of stuff. But you know, you think of probably BORTAC folks, hell, some of their kids may have been in that school. They all lived there. It was in their community. So anyway, I was going to jump back to Amanda for a second, if that's okay.
I would love to.
So she gets notified of the shooting. So she's at one of her restaurants in Jacksonville. So she gets notified of the shooting via Facebook, believe it or not. So she's doing something with one of her GMs. Her phone comes up. So she knew it because I called her. I was like, hey, I'm going to go into Publix before, at the end of my shift. And she's like, okay. And I said, do we need anything for the house? She's like, no, we're good. So she gets a notification, a federal agent shot at the Oakleaf Publix. So, of course, the 911 call goes out in Jacksonville. I'm guessing all the news stations listen to it. It goes out, you know, they put it out immediately. And then somebody in our neighborhood Facebook posts it. So she knows it. She knows I'm in there. She knows there's a good chance it's me. And she totally spaces out. So she just, you know, she was panic mode, obviously. So she just started driving. Well, the guys I flew with, it was all basically a Navy background, all Navy background. So usually in the Navy or Coast Guard, what I was in, you know, you would go to the house and notify the spouse in person. Well, that's what they were trying to do, but they couldn't find her because my wife works, you know, she's not at home making muffins. So eventually they call her, one of my best friends talks to her and says, hey, Drew's been shot. Where are you? She's like, I don't know where I am. So she had driven across Jacksonville, where if they would have just called her, you know, it would have been like, hey, stay there. We're going to send a patrol car. We're going to send a Jacksonville Sheriff's Office in. We're going to get you to the hospital. So she ended up driving. She was somewhere on the other side of town. You know, she blacked out and just started driving. Finally, my buddy said, just stop. Just tell me where you are. Just stop. Read the street signs. And that's whenever they went and got her and brought her to the hospital. So, yeah, it was pretty crazy. And I tell, when I was giving speeches, I would tell guys, I'm like, listen, especially new recruits, when I would talk to them, I'd say, have a plan. I said, you need to have a plan with your supervisor whenever you get back to wherever your duty station is. You need to have a plan. If something happens to you, you need to already have, this needs to be in place. If you get shot, if you get in a car wreck or something happens and your family needs to be notified, you need to have a plan somewhere that they can go back to and do the way you want it done. Whether you want an in-person notification, whether you want a telephone notification, you know, if you die, how you want to be buried, you know, these are tough conversations and, you know, we're all big, strong alpha, super alpha predators, whether we're males or females, you know, we're all pretty much have the same personality, you know, but you got to sit down and you got to have this conversation before you ever hit the street, and especially then put aviation into it, which makes it even more dangerous, you know, especially when you're flying helicopters and single engine airplanes down low and things like that, you know, accidents happen. So, so you're sort of in the law enforcement plus the aviation side of it. And it's super dangerous.
Yeah. I've been advocating that. And I'm, as you're saying that, cool things happen for me here too. So I wrote release a plan for mass catastrophe, or I'm sorry, I put mass catastrophe, I don't know what I put that, but for a catastrophic event is what it should say.
Yeah.
And I have my board here of things that I plan on doing. It just take a lot of time, energy, and effort, but I know a lot of places don't have anything in place, and maybe, you know, we'll be able to put something together to release to the public, to other law enforcement agencies on a action plan in event of a catastrophe, namely significant in the line of duty injury or upon the death, unfortunately, of a law enforcement officer, because nobody has it in place. And the reason nobody has it in place is because there's a lot of reasons why, and you have been around long enough in this industry to know, how come we never had this? How come this was never thought of? It's not private industry. They don't have to think about these things. It's public industry.
Right.
The duty to perform is minimal. I hate to say it. And there are people who take that job and do not accept that as the standard. And a lot of those people have really found this training company and this company to be the exception to the standard, where we show up and say, you could pay me what you want to pay me, but I'm doing this job the best way that I can.
Right.
So we need those people to come forward and take some initiative and action. Some of those people listening to this podcast may not be administrators, but may be able to find something to say to their administration, hey, I think this is important. Here's why. What do we have in place now? And hopefully these administrators have enough humility to say, you know what, that's actually a good idea.
So I learned that. So I didn't learn this until what I told you, until actually a couple of years later. So I was talking with the guy who saved my life, the first guy on the scene. His name's Jacob Hawkins, great guy. So I was doing a speech for him, for his new hires. And I was listening to before the person who went up before me was an administrator for the sheriff's department, and said, listen, you're going to get a form and you need to fill it out with your supervisor. And it's going to say exactly what I just told you. If something happens, what do you want? How do you want to be notified? Who do you want to notify? If you die in the line of duty, do you want to be buried in a suit and tie? Do you want to be buried in uniform? And they asked them all those questions and made them fill it out, seal it up, and put it in their personnel record. So I thought, well, that's pretty damn smart. And the reason why is, so we, and to back it up a little bit further, we lost a deputy in our county, I want to say around 2011, 2012, a guy named David White got killed on a knock and talk. He took a 38 to the head. Shit. And another sheriff got shot as well. This guy named Matt Hanlon. He got shot in the brachial artery in his arm. And actually had to, they didn't have tourniquets. So he took his belt off and saved his own life, right? He put a tourniquet on and he saved us because he was bleeding out, right? So when that happened, the none of the county cars had medic bags inside of them. And the sheriff at the time, this guy named Rick Beasler, said, every county car will have a medic bag inside of it from now to the end of time. So that's one thing that David White did to save me in his life. So, which I'm very appreciative of. That they had the medic bags, they had the tourniquets. The big thing, tourniquet training is so huge, I think, and putting tourniquets on and understand how tourniquets work and how they feel and how much they suck. And if you got to have one put on you in anger, you're not going to like it. So we in customs, we actually trained for that. We put them on each other. So also, I talked to his widow later, and she said, and she was telling me, she said, I was in such a bad place. It was such a shock. You know, everything that happens when you lose your spouse, especially so violently as the way that Dave died. She said, but they opened that personnel file. She said, and that's one thing I didn't have to think about. It's a decision I didn't have to make. He had already made that decision for me. And that was one thing that was taken off my plate that I didn't have to think about. And I was so thankful to him for doing that. And, so I thought about that later, and she was the one that gave the speech. She said that during that speech, and I was like, "That's pretty incredible, and it's something to think about." So
it's episodes like this that I think try to emphasize humanity and how human we have to be to each other, and try to put the bullshit to the side and the machismo associated with law enforcement. And say these are human beings involved in this profession, and I hate to say humanize the badge, because that phrase, and this is just a strictly opinion to me, that's like, it's a counter to some of this anti-police stuff. Like, let's just talk about human beings being human beings. And not only that, but the best human beings I've ever known are men and women in law enforcement. They're just the best human beings. Yep. Their souls are amazing. And the more I think about it, the more I realize that you got to be a pretty special person to want to do police work, law enforcement. You got to be a real special person. And it's not for a far majority of people.
I agree. And I'll even throw in to work on the fire services side of it, you know, to be a firefighter and have to see some of the things that they see as well. And, you know, especially on the street cop level stuff that we all see, it's just horrible. And it has to be a calling for you to get into this stuff. It's hard, man. It's rough, you know, and I was on the federal side. You know, we're not, you know, typically the feds don't see this kind of stuff, but, you know, until you do, you know, and, you know, the bullets hurt the same. They don't really care who's paying your paycheck. I can tell you that. Mm-hmm.
One thing I want to go back to, and I want to make sure we didn't miss this for everybody who's listening to this podcast episode, the shooter went to Publix to look for a cop because he knew the pattern of police officers and what they would do and why they would sit there. So my advice after hearing that is to everybody who's listening, and I say this all the time, be strategic where you sit and write your reports.
Yeah.
It's not the first time, it won't be the last time that somebody has found a cop and then hurt or killed them because they knew where to find them. So pick different locations. And if your guard's going to be down, my suggestion is find a place where you're not as visible. And I know what you're thinking. Well, I want to be visible. Oh, my boss wants me to be visible where I, where they see the police car. And I understand some of the psychology behind that.
Sure.
Or if you're going to try to do two things at once, that's fine. But if you are checking out to write a report, you're completely checking out. You're going to take 10, 15 minutes off the clock, sit down and knock a report out. You know, find a place. I used to actually go back to police headquarters sometimes and park on the deck.
Yeah.
Or I would try to find a place that nobody would know where I'm at. If I wasn't, you know, maybe trying to effect dual purpose. So that's a real important thing that you gave people today. And I promise, you know, Drew, we have over 350,000 subscribers to this podcast now. And somebody's going to hear that. And that was a real big gift that you may have just saved somebody's additional life. And we may never know that, right? You can't quantify.
Cool. Yeah. We'll never know. I just operate I think it some point has or will happen.
By the way, what you do know, though, is you have had no impact had you not decided to be on here and share that. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it would have been a disservice to your men and women in law enforcement, your brothers and sisters, to not have said that. So even if it just matters for one, in my mind, I'm like, man, if I keep one name off that wall through this training every year, maybe two, maybe three, that's a huge win. It's not the big win, but it's a huge win, at least for me. All right. Here's some more questions.
Sure.
You know, it's interesting. You're wearing that shirt, and I just saw that shirt for the first time at Tent City last 2 weeks ago.
Oh, I was there. Yeah, the Wounded Blue. Yeah.
Were you there?
Yeah, I was there.
Do you remember me walking up and talking to all the women there?
No, I wasn't at the Wounded Blue tent. I was somewhere else.
There was a guy there who looked like you at the Wounded Blue tent, the beard. I remember, I wasn't sure if it was you. And then actually, I didn't buy a lot of stuff there, but I bought shirts from them to support the cause.
Yeah, so I was hanging out with Operation Enduring Warrior, which is a nonprofit that was there. They paid to bring me up. I try to go every year just cause it just helps me, especially since I don't work in law enforcement anymore. I'm not at work. So to be around my brothers and sisters and to be around them, it really helps me psychologically, to be there and to be around them. You know, I didn't stay at Tent City all night. I didn't do anything like that. I was in bed early most nights. It just does me so much good to be out there. And then, so I actually went to the Wounded Blue. They had a thing out in Vegas last year, and they invited my wife and I both out there, and it was awesome. I had some stuff where I needed some help from one of their psychologists, and I called him up and he helped me out, basically trying to get me a new psychologist in Florida. Anyway, so it worked out. They really helped me out a lot. I mean, I made a phone call and then they immediately helped me out. So they were very good.
They seem like a really sharp group of people. And I said to them, I have great interest in continuing a relationship with all of you.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard from them yet. And I was a little overwhelmed in Tent City because there was a lot going on. And then I had to leave and my kid had a thing the next day, made communion. It was, but yeah, man. And by the way, if you run into me and you don't have a beard, and then you like expect me to know who you are, please don't find it offensive because, bro, like people do that. She's like, yo, you remember me? And I'm like, well, last time I saw you, you had a big ass fucking beard. So of course I don't remember you now.
Well, I was, all my years when I was in the Coast Guard and in the Fed, I could never have a beard. They wouldn't let us grow a beard because, you know, their excuse was in the airplane, you know, you couldn't get a seal with an oxygen mask. It's all bullshit. But anyway, so that's the first thing. Once I quit working, I was like, you know, I've always wanted to grow a beard. So, and my wife likes it. So therefore I think it'll stay around. It's not going anywhere.
How did you find out about the Street Cop Survivors Group?
Jesse Hartnett.
Oh yeah. It's my boy.
Yeah. Yeah. So Jesse reached out to me, after my shooting. I was trying to figure out how we met. And it turns out Jesse and I have a lot in common. You know, we were both in the Coast Guard,
right?
We were both in the Coast Guard at the same time. We just didn't know each other. And obviously, I knew who he was from what he went through. I mean, who wouldn't? That was several years before mine. So when he called me, you know, we had a great conversation. We've turned out to be great friends. I've been to his house now in Philly.
The new one?
Yep, the new one. Yep. My wife and I went out there and had dinner with him and his family. And he's just an incredible human being.
One of my favorite top 10 human beings I've ever met in my life.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We
were texting just a couple of days ago. We're both in RVing and he had some RV issues. It's pretty funny.
They bought an RV for 9 months and sold it.
Yeah.
That's how in and out of RVing I was, because I realized that the RVing, I had no idea the bullshit that went along with owning an RV.
Oh yeah.
It's like, you better love it, because it fucking sucks.
Yeah.
I know he's into RVs too. I'm going to see him soon. So we have our Street Cop annual summer party, and then the 4th of July at my house as well. So hopefully he'll get his ass down here. He was in the office here 2 weeks ago.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. So Jesse's good. Yeah. He's awesome.
Love that guy. How has the group been for you? And I don't say that because I'm trying to entice people to get into the group for fiduciary purposes. I'm saying this is a group of people on Facebook who are there to support each other. Has it helped?
It's been good. I don't really put out there a lot. Mostly I read. Really what I look for is maybe somebody's in trouble that you can see that they need help. And then that's whenever I'll reach out and do something and try to talk to them or comment or do something like that.
You guys are the best, bro. Like, I just don't know. Who knew that when we did this group thing in October and I just came up with this idea, I said, I think you should all be in a group together and stay in touch.
Yeah.
That everybody be so quick to help each other. You guys are amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you look at those of us who've been through this and survived, it's pretty, it's a pretty small number, I would imagine. And have for all of us to have a place to go together. If I need to bounce something off somebody, you know, if I'm having trouble or I have a question, you know, there's a picture of me out there, and you can probably find on the internet, of me actually on the ground bleeding out with Jake's finger inside my ribs. Like, you can see his arm, his fingers inside there. And I got the picture about 2 years after the shooting. Somebody sent it to me. And the first person that I sent it to was Jesse. And I said, "Hey man, I need your input on this." I said, "I'm thinking about releasing this picture. What do you think?" And, he's a super private guy, right? So he's like, "I wouldn't let it go," because I wouldn't at all. Where I'm of the opposite thing, I'm thinking, you know, people need to see this. Mm-hmm. People need to see it. It's a terrible picture, but man, you got a guy, and you can, and I'll email it to you right now if you don't see it. And I mean, you could clearly see in my eyes that I'm in trouble. I know I'm in trouble, but you can see everybody around that's helping. You can, you can see Rick Miller, one of the other guys that got there first. I have it right here. If you want to see it, I'll send it to you.
Send it to me. I'll
see. Yeah. All right. I'll send it to him.
Right. Yeah. Email to him. And he's right here. He's monitoring the podcast. So we'll get that up. Okay. I have two last questions for you, Mr. Stokes.
Sure.
what advice do you have for people going through this incident? And before you answer, tactical, professional, or personal, we've heard things like train, mindset, appreciate things in life like your family. And I don't want to lead you in any direction, but just to paint a little context of where you can go with this, and you get a shot at what you think some good advice is going through this, and a message that you want to give to people.
Slow down. Slow down. Slow your thoughts. Slow your heart rate. Assess the situation. Stay calm. And that goes for shootings. It goes for a car wreck. It goes for any type of situation that any of us could get ourselves into. When it's going down, you can't panic. And I didn't panic. Maybe have the mindset before it ever happens that it's going to happen. Just assume that sometime in your career, you're going to get shot or you're going to be in a bad car accident. Something's going to happen. Slow yourself down. Slow your heart rate down. Slow your thinking down. Don't panic and come up with it. Set. You have to change your goals. Your goals have changed. Your goals have changed from saving for your kids' college fund to making it to the next minute, to making it to the next 5 minutes. To hearing your brothers and sisters coming to get you. Understand the help is on the way. Trust what you've learned. Trust what you've been taught. You know, get that, keep that PMA. Remember that formula. Your formula for survival is PMA plus 98.6. It's your positive mental attitude plus your body temperature. I guarantee you, if I thought I was going to die in that parking lot, I wouldn't be here right now. My name would be on the wall in Washington, D.C. So I went into it with a mindset that I was going to survive. I always thought something would happen to me, and it did. But that's my advice to anybody who listens to this, is you've got to slow the incident down as it's happening, or after, or soon after it ends. That's what you have to have that for survival. Train with your tourniquets. You know, the tourniquets are life for us. Put them on. Have somebody put one on you and stop the blood flow. Period.
It's amazing.
Have them put it on. You have to. You know, like I said, we did that with all of our students. We did it in Basic Academy, which I retired as an instructor out of our academy, and then also did we did this annual, we called it STAR training. It was Standardized Tactical Aviation Recurrent Training. So, and we went through this every 5 years. Every employee, every air crew member went through this training. We all went to Oklahoma City, and we went through this training. We went again. We went through a dunker again. You know, so some, you know, might be an aviation. Somebody in aviation might be hearing this, that's law enforcement flying an A-STAR may land over water and get flipped over. Train on how to get the hell out of the helicopter. Train on how to get your seatbelt off. Train on how to shut the engine down. Train, you know, if you're going to hit the water in an aircraft, it's going to flip over upside down, and you're going to be discombobulated. You're not going to know what's going on. We train for that. Or we did, or they trained for it. Every 5 years, we had to go through these dunkers. We had to go through training. And it's the same thing. If you find yourself in an airplane underwater, slow down. Slow it down. Figure out how you can get the, how the hell you can get yourself out of this. So that's my advice.
Here's my last question.
Sure.
We know what your purpose was before this unfolded. The question is, what is your purpose now?
Same.
What do you think your purpose is now?
It hasn't changed, you know, to spread the word, to meet my brothers and sisters like you, and to continue. I want to be there for people that want to talk. You know, I'm in, and I'm not scared to say this. I'm in heavy counseling. I still am. I go, it seems every other week I've got some sort of an appointment with a psychologist or psychiatrist or something like that. And because I'm trying to, you know, we continue to battle demons even well afterwards, and I'll probably battle these demons for the rest of my life. But I also know I can't do it alone. I can't do it by myself. I need help from professionals, and everybody I've had has been great. Everybody, when the Blues been great, and during Warriors been great. You know, so it's just part of it, man. And I didn't do it for a long time, for like 3 years. I didn't do it. And I was medicating myself with alcohol, and I was not sleeping, and I had all this shit going on. And I finally said, you know what? I've got to get this fixed. I've got to start treating for it. And so that's what I've done. And I'm nowhere near out of the woods, but boy, I'm in a lot better place. That's for damn sure.
I think you're doing a really good job.
Thank you. Yeah. I would say, you know, I tell guys just, you know, if you need help, especially if the demons are coming, man, you can't be scared to ask for help. You can't be scared to, you just can't, man, because we need you in this world. We need you. And it helps all of us when you're here.
I think when we finish this podcast, you should take a minute to acknowledge to yourself how good of a job you've done.
Thank
handed
you.
Handed a fucked up situation, and, you know, give yourself some praise of the work that you've done. And it's great. And there's a lot of things to reflect on. I'm sure that happens every single day, yeah. But, I'm impressed.
Thank you.
Yeah, I am.
Thank you.
Well, Drew, it was a pleasure meeting you, and I'm sure that we will see you. I'm going to get you to come out to our Nashville conference next year.
Okay. Where is it and when? I got to put it in my calendar.
Yeah, put it in, and it's on me. So we'll figure out the details on that, but I'll have a ticket to the event for you. I will have a room for you for the week. It'll be Nashville, Tennessee. The Gaylord at Opry, April 23rd to the 28th. It is the second Street Cop Conference. And this kind of sounds like a cheap plug, but it's not, because we run commercials on this anyway. But okay. We have, just to give you some idea who we have Rob O'Neill is the guy who killed Bin Laden. He will be there.
Okay.
We have Kyle Carpenter. He is a Medal of Honor winner.
I know good well who he is.
Okay. We have Tommy Lahren from Fox News. Again, we had her the first time, and I reached out. I said, look, we're coming to Nashville. You're part of us. She shows support so much.
She's awesome.
dude, and I got to tell you, when you meet her in real life and get to have some personal time with her, mm-hmm. What a fuck ton of humility. And she might not seem like, just like me, if you ever, you probably don't have a ton of context, but when I teach, I teach with a lot of emotion. So it might seem like I'm very, I don't know, abrasive at times, but I think people get to know me. They understand that I have I really, really focus on having a fuck ton of humility. And she really sets the precedent for how maybe she appears like she wouldn't have it. She's a doll. She really is a great human being who does her very best to try to address and do the right thing with the attention that she's developed. And she is a proud supporter of law enforcement and was through the whole time that we were looked at as
the bad guys,
villains. Yeah. Villains. So, and it took a lot of strength and courage to do that. And I thank her for that publicly. And I've had reporters like, you think it's great that you have a political advisor at a law enforcement event. I'm like, guys, come on. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to play this game all day, these reporters, I'm like, well, we could play this game all day. This is somebody who has an immense amount of talent, attention, and is an outspoken supporter of law enforcement. I don't care who you are, what you do, but anybody who has the right platform that wants to use it to support us, I will certainly support them in return.
Yeah.
And we actually have more people coming up, and I can't say that yet because we're trying to finalize some details.
Okay.
And then on top of it, dude, it's an amazing event. We'll probably have around 2,000 cops there.
Oh, awesome. And
the one thing that you'll find at our event is I think this company draws the best people in this profession. The guys and girls who just didn't take this thing because they needed a job. And then we get them all together collectively with all the same mindset. And we heard that over and over again. Like, I've never met such good people in a fucking week.
Right.
And the networking and the friendships that came out of it, it's not just about going and running and gunning all day for us. It's about, we think we can change this thing for the better.
Yeah, and good. I hope so.
When I'm on my deathbed, I'm hoping somebody says, you did it. You know, you fucking did it, dude. It's a whole different thing. And to think that one person could lead the charge, myself, in trying to create substantial impact in this profession.
Yeah.
Say that publicly sounds fucking wild. People think you're nuts, but it's actually happening. Yeah. And it's not just happening because of me. It's happening because a guy like you decides he's going to share a story that happened to him. The ratchet moves a little bit more today because of you. You know what I mean? It's just true. You had a decision today. You could have said, I don't want to do this. Or you said, I could do it. So that decision that you made moved the ratchet of bettering this profession forward. And that's the truth.
I hope so. I was certainly proud to be a law enforcement officer, and I'm proud to be a part of your podcast and help you out in any way I can.
I'm so thankful that you're here, dude. I owe you so tremendously, and we do a ceremony, so you'll be receiving an award, but you just have to follow up because we're fucking busy as fuck here.
Yeah.
So just make sure that you follow up with us, and we'll get you all scheduled and set with your room and everything like that, and then we'll have a ceremony where we'll discuss and present you with an award as we do every time we do the event, even though it's the only very, very powerful ceremony. So be prepared. Last time we had that, we had 1,000 cops in Atlantic City in October. That was like right when the pandemic was ending.
Yeah.
And I went back to my room and literally just laid in tears for like 3 hours because of, I don't know, man, just that fucking ceremony brings out so much emotion. I kind of came back the next day. I'm like, what were you guys feeling? I'm like, yeah, we were all crying. You have 1,000 cops in a room crying.
Yeah.
And it's not because we're not proud of you. It's just because I think it really gets us to understand the shit that you guys have been through and how it could have been us. And I'm thankful that it wasn't me. But I'm very, and I'm very empathetic that it was you. And I'm sorry that it was you, but I'm glad that you're here. And I'm glad that you're doing a good job. You know, it's great.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
It's very heartwarming to see, Drew. It really is.
Thank you.
It's a great story with a great ending. And you get to choose the ending.
All right. Yeah.
You're writing the book, my friend.
Yeah.
Heroic ending from a man who will leave a legacy behind for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, man. It's a pleasure meeting you today.
Same here.
All right, Drew. I'll see you, buddy.
All right. Thank you. You guys have a good day.
Bye.